Hello, it's Saturday. It's the Saturday show, and on Saturday, I give you a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Sometimes it's from the vault. Sometimes it's from the week. Sometimes it's when I go elsewhere on other podcasts. That is what the nature of today's show is. I did a show called Uncertain Things. It's hosted by my friend Adam James Levin-Aretti. I never call him Adam James. I probably should call him Adam. I say Adam, and he says Adam. Anyway, well, I'm uncertain about how to pronounce the name, but he's a pal of mine. He's also dark and mysterious, but also, I think, a lot more negative than I am. So negative that the conversation turns to nihilism. And about halfway through this conversation, which we're only going to play a portion of, the whole thing ran an hour and a half. There will be a link. Listen to the whole thing. I said, I hope I'm getting this right. I think I know what nihilism means. It has to do with that special kind of breakfast sausage that they serve in lower parts of Saxony. But no, now I knew what it meant. It meant a belief in nothingness. But I said, why nihilism? What's the etymology? I way overcomplicated in my head because the nihilism just comes from the ne, meaning not, meaning belief in nothing, or nil, you know, the nil set. That's nihilism. There's also another part of the word, the hillism part. And the etymological dictionaries tell me that hillism means a little thing. It's just a little thing. Hillum, small thing, trifle. But I'm just going with the ne. It's not a small thing that we're talking about. We're talking about the nature of everything. And Adam doesn't really believe in much. And I try to pull him back from the brink. Won't you come with me? And then the second interview, that one was pretty philosophical. This one is the dark matter of string theory. This one is intense. We go deep. I don't know if you're going to be able to orient yourself without doing some reading beforehand, maybe a primer or a refresher course. But I talked to my friend Rob Schulte about his show, which is called Vanderpump Rob's. It's about the show Vanderpump Rules. Special guest Michelle Pesca sits in. We have a strong belief in things. We don't have nihilism. We don't have Jaxism. We don't have Stacia-ism. I just know some of the characters because I was made to watch the show for this particular podcast. So I wanted to present to you snippets, tastes, glimpses of a couple of podcasts I went on with the greatest range that I could possibly think of. Uncertain Things, Vanderpump Rob's, and they're both up next.
Welcome to Uncertain Things. I'm Adam, and here is Mike Pesca joining me, host, creator, dreamer of The Gist, and any other titles that I should be throwing at you?
Dream architect. Yeah. Dream architect. I breathed it into being. I looked upon the world, and I said, this shall be. I also have a Substack called Pesca Profundities. I'm thinking of changing the name now. What do you think? Someone said that's the sort of thing. It's the sort of thing that you'd name your that a clever kid who writes a high school newspaper column would name it. I was like, that was the name of my high school. No, it wasn't, but could have been.
It's the bookend of life. It is either a high school student or a retiree writing for their local Connecticut newspaper.
Yes, about these library closures.
See people in the home talking about did you read the latest profundities?
I don't know where this guy gets his stuff. Where it was all the talk of Mahjong. I don't know why I've turned everyone vaguely Jewish or specifically Jewish.
That happens. Everything leads back to it. It's a big Jewy drain. Before we talk about the Jews, I do want to ask you, and I warned you I will, I want to ask you as a businessman, as an entrepreneur of sound, and innovator of media. Mm-hmm. Give me your survey now of the landscape in the world. Actually, maybe take a step back. What world do you see yourself in? Do you see yourself as a podcaster? Do you see yourself as a news adjacent reporter?
Yes, I know what the answer would be if this were one of those business podcasts and I was looking to get clipped onto a social media feed. I'd say you have to be everything. That's the old way of thinking, that you can only be one thing. And yeah, it's true. Here's the deal. I think of myself, I think of podcasting as radio, just kind of on-demand radio. I think it's as if you were in a band and you're like, no, I don't make albums for wax anymore. I make them for cassette, or I make them for CDs, or I make them for Spotify. I don't think a good musician thinks like that. So I think of it as radio, and sometimes the radio becomes, you know, available in podcast form. But now, radio, podcasting, insufficient. Everything is video. Spotify has tried to tell us that turn all your radio shows into videos. We're doing a video here. Doesn't work on Spotify. But the thing is, and what it's trying to address, is that when it was radio, there was a radio that you could put on, and it had, I don't know, 30 stations on each part of the dial, and that alone would get you listened to. People would say, what's on the radio? So I'm getting at the issue of discoverability. And there is no discoverability in audio. People do not share audio clips. And that's for good or bad, but for growing an audience, it's bad. Discoverability can only happen through video. So this is why we do video. Weirdly, a lot of people just kind of use their video as a podcast. They say the number one podcast player is actually YouTube. And they're not using it in a different way other than everyone else watching videos. But people will, especially younger people, watch videos in the background and count it as a podcast.
It feels like those words don't mean anything anymore. It's just, these are just formats of people talking, right?
Yes. It's all content. It's all information. Information superhighway.
So I'm not, this is not a business podcast, but I do have the occasional navel-gazy curiosity about how people in my pathetic little world of news, academic curiosities, reporting and audio.
That's not pathetic.
Together.
That's not little. That's neither pathetic nor little.
It's this pond of ours. I do have to confess, though, that the only reason that I'm doing a podcast, and I think maybe listeners know this, it's pretty clear considering how much I have how little respect I have for the medium as a whole. I got into it. My colleague, partner, Vanessa, who is now on maternity leave, but usually co-hosts this podcast with me, she was a devotee of audio. She literally wrote the book about podcasting. She did. That was one of her big academic works for Columbia Journalism School. She studied the history of podcasts. That was never my interest. I love doing reporting and talking to people and then writing it down. And then I just realized that the writing it down part and turning it into an article where you also refine the eloquence of the people that you interview and you know, pull out the nuggets, that's a lot of work. And interviewing people and publishing
Indeed.
It is a lot easier. So I think I got into podcasting by being lazy.
Well, there's a certain kind of podcast that does that. They let's put it all up and let it all hang out. Then there's the, you know, bespoke, exquisitely crafted audio podcasts of Serial, and those are great.
No, that's true.
Yeah, economically speaking, they used to be podcasts. You'd think of podcasts and maybe you wouldn't think of anything, and then you'd think of Serial. And then I think you started thinking about the Daily. But those are, or at least people in a certain world would think about the Daily, those are still staffs of, you know, 20-something people and hours, hundreds of person hours put into every minute of radio. Then there's other shows that, like, it's not like Megyn Kelly or Ben Shapiro don't have a staff, but that's more like an old radio show. You talk into a microphone, maybe you film it. When here's the big difference to tell how exquisite every piece of audio is. In the world I come from, the NPR world, the following would just drive people. I mean, you couldn't do it, which is something that Ben and Megan do every day. Oh, yeah, let's go to SOT 4. It's that. It's signaling the producer in real time. Yeah, let's play clip 3. And the thing is, you know, there's this whole discussion in the world of public radio esque, but also, you know, really highly produced podcasting. How do we make the economics work? Why is no one listening to the extent that we can monetize them? Because no one cares. No one cares about, I don't know, some people care And in a certain world, you don't want the world broken up if you're doing a documentary with, hey, let's turn to clip four. But by and large, people just want to hear clip four. They don't necessarily have to hear the smooth transitions getting into clip four. And I think a lot of the people in the public radio world or the documentary world of podcasting mistake the demands of the audience, the aesthetic demands of the audience, because we really talk about aesthetics. We're not talking about a difference of information, Megan and Ben being more conservative than most of public media. So I think you can lose a lot of the bespoke kind of finely tuned portions of public radio-esque podcasting without actually losing much and saving some production budget along the way.
If we're shifting a little bit to the question of content, like the content of content, substance, how do you feel about our information environment right now? I mean, it's a big question, considering that we, even if we're just limiting ourselves to the United States, we're talking about how 300 million people are consuming information. But surely you have some thoughts about how people absorb information and sift through bullshit.
Yeah. It's pretty bad. It's pretty degraded. One of the things that's most annoying to me is that the vast majority of people who will agree with me will then say, and it is because of something like misinformation and disinformation. I think way too much emphasis has been placed on people actively trying to lie to you. And I don't think that's what's going on. I think people of different opinions, some of that's going on. But is it so much more than has always ever been thus? I think first of all, misinformation and disinformation, it's one of those pairings like Medicare and Medicaid, where they're totally different things. You know, misinformation is just something that's wrong, happens all the time. We're going to talk for an hour or so, and we'll transmit to each other probably two or three bits of misinformation. Disinformation is totally different. I think that was overblown. There was attempts at disinformation, but the last election or the election two elections ago, so much got blamed on that and it became this boogeyman, this shibboleth and all of that. But
you're talking about 2016 and
yeah, the whole idea of if we only had better hygiene in our information spaces, we'd be better informed. I don't think that's true.
If we had the firewall to prevent Putin's fire hose of bullshit from entering our
if we had the systems within Facebook, Meta, all our platforms to call out and to suss out the disinformation, misinformation, things would be better. It's impractical, and I don't think that diagnoses the problem. I think that technology allows all these voices to be heard, and then all these voices are not exactly heard, but there's a cacophony, and it becomes more audience driven, and the audience doesn't always know what it wants to hear, and
what does become more audience driven?
Everything about our information space is fractured and siloed. And so 30 years ago, when there was broadcasting and newspapers that strode communities like behemoths, those newspapers knew that they were kind of writing for everyone. And as such, there was an incentive to be accurate, because if you were inaccurate, a large percentage of your readership or listenership would notice and object. But these days, since everything is fractured, you could be inaccurate or only portray one side of the issue, and you're really only going for a narrow slice of the audience. So to take a newspaper, you know, it used to be that you had a lot of take a left-leaning newspaper now, Philadelphia Inquirer. They knew that they had many readers within their coverage area that were going to object, not just if you told them something that they didn't agree with, but if you misrepresented facts, right? And you'd have advertisers who objected to that, and you were hiring, you know, the whole world was different and we weren't as polarized, but you were hiring a bunch of people who didn't come up being ideologically driven in the first place. Now all those incentives have fallen away. So you could basically just tell one side of the story. That's fine. The Philadelphia Inquirer doesn't realistically aspire to be a newspaper for all people. And hopefully it works out with your third of the audience that is more or less where you are ideologically. And it's even truer for podcasts. So I think that I think we're in a pretty bad place. We don't have totally accurate or sufficiently accurate gatekeepers. Bad information gets out there, and you just want your fellow citizen to have some sort of basis of reality, some sort of shared reality. And I don't think we have enough of that. And I know that there are going to be a whole bunch of people who are ideological or trying to convince you of something, but I would like it for some sort of referee or the self-appointed fact checkers or the big legacy institutions to still really take seriously. I can't be wrong on this. If I call something fact-checking, the facts have to be right. And I don't see that going on. I see ideology having inflected so many portions of media.
So I of course, heard that the story being told as we have lost the centralization of media, and as a result, and the result of that and the fracturing, the disbundling or unbundling of products, all of that together, all those processes together lead to the loss of any kind of central authority to sift through truth and the loss of the incentives to even do so. But don't you feel like we're also going through something a little deeper than that, some actual epistemic change in our priorities? Because I don't know if I can even really point to many people in our fields that seem to truly prioritize a sense of accuracy above anything else. And that comes not just from the changes in incentives. The changes in incentives perhaps highlight it and galvanize it, but you'll be hard-pressed to name 10 people with prominent spots that seem to truly care about holding their own quality of reporting to a higher standard and are not swept by whatever delusion their side might have at a single moment.
Oh, I disagree with that. I think that there are a lot of people who really, really want to be accurate. And I think Sulzberger of the New York Times wants to. He wants to be seen as accurate, but he also wants to be accurate. He's operating within a system like anyone. He has a constituency, right? He has a lot of people who write for him who are maybe further to the left than he would like them to be publicly. But he has pulled the newspaper back. He knows that the whole trend of rejecting objectivity wasn't good for the credibility of his newspaper. He wrote about this and CJR. He can't go straight ahead and say, no, objectivity is what we do. The phrase, I mean, we engage in these word wars. The phrase has been degraded, but essentially that's what he's saying. We need to get back to objectivity. Many of your listeners will say he hasn't done it yet. We're always going to criticize the New York Times. I just had an article in the Day We Speaking Out on the Free Press today. Very, very critical of a piece of New York Times coverage about a police shooting. But at the same time, they've also hired writers and thinkers who are corrective to that sort of thing. So I think the New York Times essentially wants to do it. I think some of the retired people at the Washington Post and some of the people still there want to do it. Jeffrey Goldberg's in the news today. I mean, I know people on the right will slam him, but I really think he wants to be accurate. He carried himself pretty heroically in this whole Signal situation. I think that we could go through some of the big newspapers, some of the even big networks, and they do. There are many people who really do want to be accurate.
And saying you think that the driving motivator there is an ethical belief in accuracy, in putting aside the word objectivity, just in being factual and
yeah. I think the New York Times. Yeah, I was just talking to an editor at the New York Times, and I know that he and his colleagues talk all the time about being accurate. It's accurate within a world which the best among them will recognize comes from, you know, a certain milieu, and the assumptions are not that, you know, abortion is bad. Not that abortion is bad. The assumptions are not that, you know, tariffs are good. There are certain assumptions based on where they come from and what they all believe. But yeah, they do want to be accurate. Many, many of them do. Most of them do. I mean, there is a debate, right? Wasn't there a debate within journalism whether to go with what was called the moral clarity journalism, the jettisoning of objectivity versus, no, let's keep on doing, call it something else, if you will, but objectivity has its place. The fact that there was a debate about that tells you that there's more than 10 people who believe in accuracy, objectivity, that moral clarity, that kind of journalism will get us into a bad place.
So, okay, so put aside my false minion of 10.
the false minion, yeah.
I might be misreading vibes, but I don't think that the Lowy argument, which was the journalist who wrote, was it? I don't remember who he wrote it about the against objectivity, and then the whole.
Yeah. He wrote an op-ed for the New York Times.
For the Times?
Yeah, they also profiled him. Masha Gessen wrote a big profile of him that set that along in the mm-hmm. New Yorker. And then he was brought in to sort of remake the Philadelphia Inquirer in right. the wake of, you know, huge scandals like an editor saying buildings matter too and being fired after the Black Lives Matter protest took hold.
Right. And then A.G. Salzberger, the publisher, responded to this. We actually interviewed him about his piece at the Dispatch. Yeah, that conversation has its own internal self-satisfied almost academic quality to it, but the truth is that the consumers are not interested in it seems to me really in any kind of that high-minded self-standard towards accuracy. And even in such a lofty organization as the New York Times, and I say actually lofty more in the sense of their reach and their being able to still being held accountable to a wider audience, the way you're imagining the publishing houses of yore, they have probably the biggest reach and therefore the most diverse audience. I like just going through some of the reactions in the in their own comment sections and then in the conversation outside of this, it doesn't seem like I shouldn't exaggerate, but it seems like very few people are there to put money for that kind of internal struggling. I know that the people who pay for the Dispatch are almost entirely there for the sort of self-criticism and nuance. And when they hear the whiff or experience just a touch of heat from a take, they are turned off. But those are people who have been literally trained, and our audience, I'm afraid to say, does not quite meet the New York Times or the Daily Wire's numbers. I do think that the majority of people who are willing to actually pay for news want some kind of righteous indignation on one side or the other at the expense of accuracy.
Yeah, it's probably true that for the majority of news consumers, or at that point, are they even news consumers, opinion consumers? But there are plenty of counterexamples. The Dispatch, you know, it's probably true that Dispatch readers, if you serve them just a bunch of things that challenge the worldview, their worldview going in wouldn't like it. Who does? I have this conception that there is a certain kind of person, and I'm one of them, who does like being challenged, but I don't like being challenged 75% of the time, right? And even if there is an outlet that will challenge me 75% of the time, I have to mix that into my news diet kind of gingerly. So that's one thing. But I think the Dispatch is a good example. There's this other news service that Isaac Saul has started called Tangle News. Do you know it?
Yeah.
So it's great. It's Isaac writes up, here's five views from the left, here's five views from the right, and here's my view. And he really, really, he's like a monk. He tries to take himself and the ego out of it. He'll give you his opinion, but he really tries to be unbelievably fair. And they've just hired their, hey, look, this isn't going to blow you away and it's not going to make the New York Times jealous, but they've just hired their seventh or eighth staffer and they make in the low single digits of millions of dollars in revenue. So this to me, and the Dispatch is doing well, this to me shows that there is an appetite for it. It's also strange when I read the New York Times comments section, a lot of the articles that go against what you would think would be the stereotypical critique of the New York Times is a left-leaning rag. I think specifically on the transgender issue, there would be so many comments saying if there's an article that is just a good journalistic article, and they have done them on what WPATH or some of these other organizations that are rethinking or at least thinking critically about gender identity and youth, you know, so many people say, thank you. This is sensible. This is what I need. I'm trying to navigate this and get to the truth. Now, look, people will say that about the very ideologically inflected places too. Pick a place that we're like, all right, we know where they stand, be it the Daily Wire or the Intercept. You'll get a bunch of comments saying, thank you for telling the truth. Everyone defines the truth that way. But as I see the willing to be challenged and know that my truth isn't the only truth, as I see that as a niche, I think it's a, I think that there is possible and demonstrable money to be made there. I think that there's a big enough market for that.
So let's assume that your optimism is justified, or that you're, it's not optimism, that you're just seeing things clearly. How does this help us? The reality is that you alluded to the Signal story, and maybe you can unpack it to our listeners. I know that a lot of the Uncertain Things listeners are not necessarily so news obsessed, so they sometimes come here for more esoteric discussions of Tom Holland. Yeah. I think I have a good hold on the Tom Holland fan club in my listenership. So they don't necessarily have read the news today. So maybe give them a rundown on this, and then let me ask you a question about news as it pertains to this.
We're speaking on Tuesday. Is today Tuesday? I never know the day. Yeah. So I don't know. Is this going to air today, tomorrow?
Probably tomorrow.
This is going to be, I predict it's going to be ubiquitous. But Jeffrey Goldberg was invited to a Signal chat.
Editor-in-chief of the Atlantic.
Editor-in-chief of the Atlantic, a journalist who didn't ask for this, gets a Signal invite on the app Signal, which is an encrypted app from Mike Waltz, who's a national security advisor. He doesn't really know Waltz. He joins this group, and the group winds up being a principals committee that is discussing what turns out to be the strike on the Houthis that the United States took on March 16th. And for a long time, Goldberg says, I thought I was involved in some sort of operation where they're fishing for my information, because that happens a lot. But then it turns out to be real. He's privy and reports on the internal discussions of Pete Hegseth, J.D. Vance, other people debating and discussing what's going to happen. It does happen exactly as they say it's going to happen, thus confirming that he was in the group. And then Goldberg is very responsible and doesn't give away undercover identities of CIA operatives, doesn't give away details of the mission that couldn't peril anyone. What's interesting to me is two things. One, Democrats are making hay of this. Hay should be made. Is this a violation of the law? Possibly, could be. Certainly a violation of regulations. Certainly unsafe. Certainly incautious. All those questions should be made. I appreciated the insight that I got of how the deliberations occurred, where you saw J.D. Vance in private and with a group of 18 people he thought were, you know, high cabinet officials and such, kind of behaving like he does not in private, where he raises what he thinks are the most important issues, which are, let's not do this to help the Europeans. Europe benefits more from the shipping of the Suez Canal. This is why they hit the Houthis, because the Houthis were striking at ships in the Suez Canal. You know, this is something that will help Europe more than it will help us, and I don't want to help Europe. The other members of the channel were like, well, even though you're right, JD, of course, we all hate Europe. You know, we should hit the Houthis because President Trump said hit the Houthis. And then, and this dynamic is fascinating, Stephen Miller, advisor, who titularly or on the org chart, certainly in the aren't as high as he is, certainly aren't in line to be president. But he comes in and said, no, I heard the president say he wants to hit the Houthis. Boys, we're hitting the Houthis. And hit were the Houthis. The Houthis were hit. So that's all really interesting. Another interesting aspect is Hegseth said, you're right, JD. No one really knows who the Houthis are. So how we have to sell this is, one, Biden was weak, and two, they're backed by Iran. And I remember on my show, on The Gist, I played a bunch of clips, and one was Mike Walls saying, you know, they're backed by Iran, and Biden was feckless. And then I played a clip of Hegseth going on Fox News with Maria Bartiromo saying, the reason we did this was shipping lanes and freedom, but also Biden was weak and they're backed by Iran. So it was really interesting to see the difference between the private and the public. I shouldn't have been able to see it, but that's the lesson and the gate of the Signal gate, as they're sometimes calling it.
I don't even know where to start.
The only person I'm having a problem with is you.
Do you even know me? Do you even know me, dude?
This was years of friendship that I thought would last forever.
Being an obnoxious person right now.
Katie, you're just a bitch to me all the time.
You can't be real for one second, Kristen.
Suddenly, everything kind of turned upside down. Just raise your
glasses high. So you're not exclusively dating this girl?
I'm interested in you.
Were you guys hanging out alone?
I mean, it's great to have new faces, but their problems seem as complicated as their predecessors.
Knock in these out. You've never been happy in your life.
Woman to woman, be careful.
If you don't love me for who I am, then bye-bye.
This is called a dysfunctional relationship.
Look at her in the eyes until you don't have feelings for her.
I don't!
You selfish, egotistical piece of shit.
I just want to get in my car and drive away and never come back. This one's
for you tonight. Okay, let's get started.
Okay, mark it.
Wait, Rob? Is that who we're talking about?
Yeah.
Rob and I are very much in love.
Yeah.
Rob has a very hard time expressing that.
Banter. Pump. Banter. Pump. Banter. Pump. Banter. Pump. Rob.
Yeah.
Rob makes me so f***ing happy.
Yeah.
Rob's never mad. I've never in 11 years seen him mad.
Yeah.
Rob, he likes coffee with his creamer. Like, I can't wait for, like, Rob and I need a house one day. Rob and I are gonna have, like, two kids.
Yeah.
Banter. Pump. Banter. Pump. Banter. Pump. Banter. Pump. Rob.
Yeah.
Welcome to Vanderpump Rob's, a podcast about Hollywood. On today's episode, I welcome my former Park Slope neighbors from the GIST podcast team. It's host Mike Pesca and CBSO of Peachfish Productions, Michelle Pesca. Welcome to Vanderpump Rob's.
Thank you, Rob.
Thanks, Rob.
Hey, this is a long time coming. You know, when I used to live above you, I was like, I hope I'm just not stomping too loud, you know.
Never.
But one day they're going to come on my Vanderpump podcast that doesn't exist yet. And
we were just talking about this, and we said Rob had a light, almost balletic touch, which breaks upon the floor above us.
I sprinkled sand on the floor and did a little soft shoe.
You would do that, when you would do those acts, it was just bring us back to a simpler time of vaudeville.
Uh-huh. Well, this is great. I wanted to just right off the top, if any of my listeners have been living under a podcast rock, I want to give you the opportunity to just pitch the GIST, let them know why they need to listen to it, and then we'll get into all of this other business of Vanderpump.
Shall I, or would you like to?
I think you're best suited.
The GIST is the longest running news and analysis podcast, we think, in existence. I don't know. I haven't surveyed the Spanish speaking world, but that is our understanding. And every day I talk about the news and I give it some analysis and I do an interview. And my take is, although it's an opinion show, I really don't bludgeon you with an opinion. I really try to draw out of my guests the best arguments that they could offer. So sometimes that's by challenging them. Sometimes that's by follow-up questions. I have been accused recently of going too easy on the artsy guests. I should go harder on them like I do the political or philosophical guests. And I was thinking about that. Maybe it's true. Maybe I'm overly deferential to the arts, because what they do and what they create is amazing. It's also opt-in, right? It's not torturing the rest of us if they get it wrong. But I have done the show for over 11 years, and if seeing how our civilization is going, I hope to do it for 11 weeks more.
Hey, it makes sense. And I do have to say, you could have gone harder on past guest of this podcast, Jim O'Hare.
That guy just skated.
Yeah.
Was he Larry? Gary?
We need to know. He needs to be honest with us, and it's quite all right. But I love the podcast, and I'm so happy you're both here. But let me ask you both this, and Michelle, we can start with you. Where does reality TV fit into your lives? Like, is it something that you once watched? Were you Survivor fans? Were you Were you Bachelor fans? Do you watch Vanderpump Rules or any shows other than that?
So there's a divide in our house, and I'm not going to say it's obvious, but maybe it is to some. I have been a longtime reality TV watcher, not an obsessive one, but I have my favorites. I've been a big Bravo person. I've watched most of the Real Housewives franchises. And then, of course, obviously, Vanderpump Rules being a major offshoot of Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. So I've watched it from the beginning. I will say, though, there was a fall off for me, not an intentional one, but it has not been a big part of my life as of late. And so I didn't see season 8 or beyond, although I do know some of the chatter around the scandals. And
oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And as for me, I'm going to say some things, possibly overstate some of my opinions just to be provocative, as a provocateur. But I think reality TV is a deleterious development that is threatening society. There, I've said it.
Okay.
I do think that one of the first ever interactions I saw between Michelle and her mom, they started talking about, oh my God, did you see when they went to the medium? And I thought that, I don't know, like who was one of the New York housewives who went to a medium, or maybe it was New Jersey.
No, it was Beverly Hills.
Anyway, did you see that Lisa, the medium, said this? I'm like, who are these people?
Getting all the
who are these people
wrong,
who you think, who you're talking about? Never heard you talk about these people. And they were, are you sure it was Beverly Hills, the medium?
I am definitely.
I thought they were like,
yeah, it was a big dinner opinions. Thing with Kyle and like,
yes.
It was.
But it could have been any Housewives franchise or any episode of Vanderpump Rules, because a medium or a psychic or someone with crystals or a Reiki healer, they're always going to infiltrate the
case
season.
Of emergency, break woo-woo glass. Yes.
I also want to say that Mike has always been a huge critic of reality TV, just like, you know, he couldn't believe that like I was watching it, yet however I would be watching it, and he would like just kind of dance around in the background, like coming in and out of the room and asking me questions about the episodes. He obviously was like very interested, even though he fiend that he was not.
A couple of things. One, it is because I'm uxorious. Do you know what uxorious means, Rob?
Nobody does.
I'm not going to pretend to know what it means.
It's one of my favorite words, and it's so apt. It means, it describes an excessive love for one's wife. So I am uxorious.
Oh, my
and
God.
If her interests are my interests, and all these things take so much time, and I want to know. So that's point one. Point two is, I'm not saying these things aren't effective, and I'm not saying these shows aren't interesting anthropologically. And I'm definitely not saying they don't hit the reptilian part of our brain. So they are interesting, right? We're human beings. We like looking at other human beings. The editing is wizardry. So, you know, I'm interested in it in a meta way, but also I'm interested in Michelle. So we could talk about things that occur on the show. I remember watching the Bravo Network when it was the Ovation Network, and they programmed a lot of opera. And that is, you know, more of my hybrid thing.
Oh, my God. Yeah, he is so course. Going hard on trying to make sure that everybody who is watching this knows that he's an intellectual. And it's a sad wife who has interest in reality TV, and he's only interested in an ancillary way.
Can I tell you what my reality TV is? It's fantasy football and fantasy basketball. I'm not a highbrow intellectual.
Well, I will say that like there's been an argument made lately, especially after some of the bigger scandals that resulted in this show totally like retiring the current cast and like rebooting the series next year, that people have made arguments that reality TV is now a new form of sports. Right. It is, you're invested in something that really doesn't have an effect on your day to day life. You talk about it at the virtual water coolers. You know, it's big on social media, and it's just a different echo chamber than, you know, talking about the Chiefs or the 49ers or, you know, the Denver Nuggets. You know, those are all sports teams because I'm a big sporto too. And I kind of like that idea. I think it makes shows that are seemingly eye-rolly a little bit more approachable in, you know, social situations.
I like that comparison because there's always this amazing justification of this huge waste of time for people like this guy about like his sports consumption. And I mean, there's no difference, Rob. And I think you've nailed it.
Here, among the differences were these. First of all, I liked how you said Denver Nuggets with suspicion. I think the ultimate team to be suspicious of, it would go something like the Knicks or the Lakers or the Jacksonville Jaguars. There's something about them, especially during the Blake Bortles era, that lended itself to suspicion. Here's the difference. It would be like sports as if the greatest athletes of the world were not, in fact, the greatest athletes, just maybe looked pretty good. And they went out onto a field and played some game of mediocre pickup basketball. And then through editing, they made it seem like they could dunk and shoot three-pointers and come back from injuries. That's how it would be sports. It's an interesting human, where as human beings, we're storytellers, we're interested in stories, we're interested in other human beings. It's interesting anthropologically. And the way that reality TV and sports are alike is that as animals who are interested in the other human animal, the anthropology kicks in. And so we're interested in the story of our sports teams, and we're interested in the stories of these concocted characters. And I'm overdoing it. I really don't look down on anyone who watches it. Get your information how you want. Play video games. Glory in anything that makes you happy in this hard workaday world, I say.
Well, I mean, the Costco guys were just on AEW Pro Wrestling, so everything's up in the air. I don't know what to believe anymore.
Right.
But maybe we should move into what we're watching today. I wanted to bring you on for season 8, episode 1, because I feel like season 8 of Vanderpump Rules was a turning point that everyone now in the fandom looks back on and is like, oh, I hated that season. They tried to introduce too many new people. But really what it was, this was a point where the show could have gone one way and it could have gone the way that it did go. And the way that it did go is that because of some of the social movements happening or re-happening during the COVID lockdown and some past tweets that came up, like a lot of people got fired after this season. Some argue maybe it was, Bravo covering their ass. Some people say they're actually trying to like put it, but then they rehired some of the cast for a spinoff show years later. So what does that tell you? But really, when we look at this season and we look at this pilot episode, they are trying to do something where we're like, these people no longer work at this restaurant and we are just following their lives as millennials who were once in one-bedroom apartments and are now buying houses and moving to the valley and moving on with their lives. But we're going to introduce new people that still have to work in the service industry and try and have the best of both worlds. It aired January 7th, 2020. The title is There Goes the Neighborhood, and the BravoTV.com description is Jax, Brittany, Schwartz, Katie, Sandoval, and Ariana all move into their very first grown-up houses while Stassi struggles to rebuild her broken friendship with Kristen. Newly sober Lala confides in Lisa Vanderpump about her desire to make amends with an old friend, disgraced James Kennedy, and TomTom general manager Max breaks the rules by dating the new hostess Dana, much to his ex-girlfriend Sheena's dismay. Finally, Jax retaliates when Tom Sandoval skips one of his wedding events. A lot of this is... Well, I was going to say that was written by ChatGPT, but I think it was just written by an unpaid intern. But because now they're all written by ChatGPT, and it shows. But before I dive into the tent poles of this episode, any questions about Vanderpump Rules I can clear up leading into this episode?
I have some questions because Mike was asking me a lot of, like, while we were watching the episode, like, really, like, I'm like, you obviously know nothing about this, but I have
for humanity.
Yeah. I mean, he was asking such basic questions, like, oh my God. But because I was an avid watcher and then apparently I dropped off, and I'm not really sure when I dropped off, but like you said, like there were new characters in this episode that I didn't know. Like, mm-hmm. I know the Stassis and the Toms and, like, I know those people, but there were like new characters, and I'm like, Are they first being introduced now, or was I supposed to know? Because they just went hard into a plot line, and I'm like, was I supposed to know?
No, these were just brought in. We knew nothing about them, and then they are just trying to, you know, maybe retroactively make us think. Maybe they're gaslighting us.
It made me question my knowledge of the show.
They were here the whole time.
Sitcoms, right? On Family Ties, Mallory has a favorite aunt who dies, and they never mentioned the aunt before. So
yep.
It's classic.
Why is my cousin a different actor every single time he comes onto the show?
Yeah. So that was one thing that I was like thinking as we were watching the episode. And then I was also, you know, knowing some of the future stuff, I was sort of thinking about that, mm-hmm. reflecting. I don't know all of the details. So I wanted to ask you if you thought there was anything relevant in the future that was important to know while watching this episode.
Yeah, the big thing here is season 10 was the Scandoval season. Season 11 that just ended a few months back was like the fallout of that. Scandoval, of course, being the Tom Sandoval scandal, where he has moved into this house with Ariana. They've been together for 8 or 9 years, but it turns out over the past, you know, it probably started like just after this season filmed, but he started dating or having an affair with the woman named Raquel, who we see briefly at the beginning of this episode.
Now Rachel, right?
Now Rachel. Her real name was Rachel. Raquel was her TV name, I guess. Which is something important because as you see him interact with people, and especially this argument he has with Jax throughout this episode, I think it's fair to say that Tom Sandoval is someone who believes his own lies to justify actions, mm-hmm. and like a greater good sort of situation. And that can come up a little bit more as we talk about it. But I do think it's important to know that he has a wandering eye. So to see him like moving in with Ariana is kind of like, oh God, I know what's coming. This is a terrible.
Is it controversial to say, like, because I'm not in the fandom world.
Sure.
Is it controversial to say that Tom Sandoval is disgusting? Like,
yes. No, it's not controversial.
What is the appeal? I do not get it.
Well, he shaves his forehead, which is apparently for exfoliating purposes, and I've always questioned him ever since then. But I also think there's something interesting to say that, like, culturally speaking, the guys more often than the ladies get passes on this show. And a lot of Bravo shows, I do think, tries to pit women against each other. And it's interesting to see, like, the fight between Jax and Tom is really just like two bros having a misunderstanding, right? We all get it. And that's just something to keep in the back of your mind. So it's a beautiful day in West Hollywood, and Tom Sandoval and Tom Schwartz arrive to their bar, Tom Tom, looking like a couple of spray tanned James Bonds at Tom Tom, which they own 2.5% of, Lisa Vanderpump.
No.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah. It's not their bar, but
did not know that.
Yeah. We meet Max and Dana, who work together and recently hooked up. Naughty, naughty. But luckily, there's no HR department in the Vanderpump verse because it doesn't matter. Dana is moving to Sir, a.k.a. the sexy, unique restaurant. So Dana and Max can date all they want in West Hollywood.
Is Max with it? By the way, your description and analysis does make it quite fascinating. Is Max in the fandom considered like good looking and attractive? Because I was a little confused by that.
That's a good question. I think most people just dislike him. And
But not for aesthetic reasons, for more personality, moral.
Yeah, I think more personality and past tweet reasons and
past tweets, right?
Most, you know, public notes app apology reasons. And realistically, he's just a, you know, playboy.
Mike was very confused by the fact that he could even obtain that status. The whole time he was like, I don't, like, you know, Mike has like a particular, I guess, sensibility about like what an attractive man is without actually being attracted to men. And so he was like, I'm not getting this. And yeah, I'm like, I can't explain it either. I mean, he's all right, but
I'm like, is this guy? He looks like a guy who works in a shoe store. Right? And anyone can work in a shoe store. But
that's true. And I think that it's, when you wear that many colors, you're overcompensating for something, but we'll see.
That tall, skinny guy who's the new server at Sir, that's a good looking guy. And I think some of the toms, like 2.5% of the toms are okay, you know?
Max,
fella.
Max is questionable, and I think we see that later on when he's very sus. I think he likes to get his Apple Watch and run is really the situation. But speaking of Sir, we do head over there where we do meet Brett, the new server, who in a future episode, we find out he was actually Lisa Vanderpump's like personal trainer, and that's how he got a job there. So he should be looking fit if that's his day job.
You know?
I do love Sheena explaining the unwritten rules of working at Sir, which is like, hey, don't date anyone. I did it. I ended up getting my heart crushed, but I also am divorced, but it doesn't define me. And it's like, where are we going with this conversation?
That was so crazy. Also, I do have to tell you that while we were watching the episode, I kept saying, they're divorced. Yeah. They're divorced. They're divorced. They're not together. Like, I just can't. Like, nobody's together anymore.
But I thought, I just can't. And when she said, I was like, well, that's good. I mean, obviously, none of these people should be married or would be without the artifice of the show.
Yeah.
Good.
No, that's not. I told them that's not true.
Not married to anyone, just married to each other.
No, Katie and Tom were like together for a long time.
You're saying it was a pressure cooker and they.
Maybe, yeah.
I think there's a little bit of. I'm on both of your sides here. Oh, God. But because. I think there's pressure from the show to feel like, whether it's subconscious or not, that you feel like relationships keep you employed.
Relevant, also,
And relevant, it gives you a storyline. But also, like, Tom Schwartz does not like Katie. Like, it's unfortunate. Clear. And, like, when you go back and watch these old episodes, I think it's just a relationship of convenience. And, look, no judgment, I get it. It happens, but when you pair that to income and household income, it gets really messy really quickly.
He always struck me as like the kind of guy that's like, can't really think for himself too much. And he just like waits to be told what to do. And like, he's a good looking guy and maybe that's part. And he's like a chill guy. So maybe that's part of his appeal. But like, he seems to just go where he's told. And I don't think that's a good way to get the best out of life.
Yeah, I think Tom Schwartz very much is a, hey, I'm just going to take it. I don't make a plan because if I make a plan can get canceled. And we all hate that sort of person, at least on this side of the computer screen. And it is one of those things where like that, he's not the only one I've heard that from, right? I think a lot of these people really don't like to commit to anything, whether it be relationships or work.
Yeah. You
know? Is Katie the one from Kentucky or the only brunette?
No.
Katie's the brunette. Brittany's from Kentucky.
Okay. Katie's the only brunette in the show, right?
Sheena is also a brunette.
Sheena, right. Sheena,
I remember, I think Katie, during one of the reunion episodes, whatever, that they showed a clip of, she had either a scratch or a lipstick right on the side of her lip.
Yes. Katie actually, and this is, you know, I'm no doctor, but at one point Katie like fell through a ceiling and
shattering the glass ceiling. Good for Katie.
That's what we're all saying, but I think that's where that scar came from.
Oh, it's a scar. That's right.
And
I remember that.
Yeah.
But the scar doesn't define her.
But I also want to point out that Mike claims that he did not watch this show and has no interest in it, but somehow just referenced a reunion episode.
No, they showed the flashback. Yeah. It was in grainy, like saturated tones. Cool. So you know what happened.
Letting us know that it's old times.
They not orient the viewer. The viewer's never confused. Like, where am I?
I have to applaud them on editing on this show because at one point, probably around season four, I think the editors got together and were like, we can really make this a comedy if we just play with this audio a little bit.
Very good.
Yeah. That's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara and Michelle Pesca as our far-flung CBSO. Umperu, Jeeperu, Duperu. Thanks for listening.